You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 13th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, Phil Plate.
Hey, hey.
What?
Phil.
Hey. Special? Phil Plate. I've been on this more than you.
You have been on more than Bob. We established that
recently. Yeah, right.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the show, Phil.
Oh, it's my pleasure, too. I always have a fun time doing this. Wherever I go, whenever I give a talk or something, somebody always comes up to me and says, you know, I first heard you on Skeptic's Guide. So I think that's really cool.
So what's new, Phil?
Nothing. Astronomy's, okay. You know, we're done. We've discovered
universe
everything.
Is still there.
Figured everything out?
Yeah. Saw everything, huh?
Sad.
So, good.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Leaves a bit more time for hobbies.
Watching Doctor Who.
Hey, happy 50th anniversary to Doctor Who.
Yay.
He's 50?
That was a sad little celebration, you guys. Yay.
And there was much rejoicing.
Fantastic.
I love it when the audience does all the work for us. Andrew Antaro emailed in and said that the Doctor Who 50th anniversary is on Saturday, November 23rd. Because of that, he even took the extra step of sending in some sound files from Doctor Who. He went back to the very first skeptical quote that he could find. 16 minutes and 3 seconds into the pilot, he heard the first skeptical quote, which was,
"You don't understand, so you find excuses."
By William Hartnell, the first Doctor. And then he also included another skeptical quote from Matt Smith.
"The ship is cursed."
Yeah, right. Cursed. It's big with humans. It means bad things are happening, but you can't be bothered to find an explanation.
So some skeptical quotes from a generally unskeptical show. Well, fantasy-driven show, at least. But now that you guys have finally caught up, and I think we're all Doctor Who fans, I think we can all appreciate the fact that this is the 50th anniversary.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally have my daughter's hook too. I wouldn't say that it's an unskeptical show. I think that the show, yes, it's very fantasy driven, science fiction fantasy, but the Doctor as a hero is great. He's nonviolent. He uses knowledge and smarts to figure things out, to solve problems. He's like the most dangerous man in the universe because he's a really smart guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And he has a TARDIS and he can travel
TARDIS.
To time and space. Yeah.
I guess by unskeptical, I merely mean that it's not the sort of show where everything ties together and makes sense if you think about it too much.
Yeah, it's a time travel show, so, you know.
There's a lot of timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly stuff that you just sort of forgive because it's entertaining.
Yeah.
You know.
Craig Ferguson said it best, and he said that Doctor Who is the triumph of intellect and romance over brute force and cynicism.
That's very nice.
That's like fair. It. Phil, who's your favorite Doctor?
They all are. It's only one Doctor.
Come on, pick a favorite.
Well, you know what? I really like David Tennant, and I was not happy with Matt Smith at first, but I've kind of grown into him, and I really like him now. So I wouldn't say he's my favorite, but I like him a lot.
The correct response was David Tennant.
Yeah, David Tennant is correct. However, I'm really looking forward to Peter Capaldi.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved him on, well, basically everything else he's ever done, but I absolutely loved him on The Thick of It, but I don't know. I was really disappointed that they went with another same old, same old for this choice.
It's what do you mean? By that, do you mean a white male?
Yeah. British? Older, British, white male. Yeah. It's like, you know, come
but
on.
What are the parameters of the regeneration, though? I mean, does the regeneration...
It's Doctor Who, right? There's no parameter that cannot be easily changed. But anyway, there is no parameter, and you know they've had mentions of female time ladies in the past. There's nothing that prevents them from using a person of color or a woman. So yeah, it was a little disappointing, but I love that actor, so I'm interested to see what he'll do with it. But I'd be lying if I said I wasn't a little disappointed.
Yeah, I know. I read all the speculation about that. Is it going to be a woman? Is it going to be a person of color? And, you know, expanding the role is in, the character is interesting. But at the same time, the character of the doctor is, it's not unreasonable to say that there are certain characteristics that the doctor will always have. Because, you know, you don't want to change the character too much. I could see an argument being made in both directions.
Yeah, there's just nothing about the doctor that I think is explicitly white, for instance. The doctor is zany and smart and, you know, clever, but not white.
Yeah.
Like, whiteness isn't really a...
They have established that your race can change between regenerations.
Yeah.
With River Song. But not sex. As far as I know, sex or gender has never changed with regeneration.
No, I think they did reference that. I don't have it at the tip of my fingers, but they have referenced it in the past.
Well, I was hoping for Jennifer Saunders.
Who's that? Would have been amazing.
From Absolutely Fabulous.
Uh-huh. Or the one thing that I think will never happen is an American doctor.
I hope not.
The British are so possessive of their doctor. Even just when, you know, from our brief mention of it last week on the, or 2 weeks ago on the message board. So one of our British listeners was like, it's so weird to hear Americans talking about the doctor. He's our doctor.
Oh, God.
You know what I think would be great is if Peter Capaldi regenerates and then immediately dies. and they're all like, psych.
Well, let's give John Hurt a chance and see what happens.
Yeah, what's up with John Hurt?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll find out in a week.
That's right.
Let's go on to some actual news items now. Phil, so when we bring you on, we sort of, I've saved up a few astronomy-themed news items. You know, when a couple of them hit, and we're like, yeah, you know what? I should get Phil on the show, and we'll just do a bunch of astronomy news items. So the first one I want to talk about is the recent estimate of the number of Earth-like planets that are out there in the galaxy.
Yeah, this is very cool. And let me start right out here and say that work like this has been done before. We are discovering a lot of these planets orbiting other stars, exoplanets. And at first there weren't that many, and they were all kind of weird, sort of like big Jupiter-like planets orbiting really close to their sun, very much unlike the Earth. But as we got better at this, we started finding smaller planets. It turned into less of a, you know, we've discovered a new planet, into more of a cataloging them. Once you have enough of them, you can start putting them into nice little bins, like these are too close, these are too far, this one's got an atmosphere, this one doesn't, that sort of thing. When you do that, you start getting statistics. And when you've discovered close to 1,000 planets, we're right around 1,000 planets right now, you start to get decent statistics. And basically, this is another way of going through all of the planets that we've discovered and categorizing them, and then extrapolating that to see how many are Earth-like. And in this case, we're starting with the Kepler Space Telescope, which is a telescope that's out in space, oddly enough, staring at one patch of the sky in Cygnus, the Swan, in the northern hemisphere, northern sky. And it's looking at one spot all the time. And it's looking at about 150,000 stars. And what it's looking for is if a planet is orbiting a star, and we happen to see the orbit of that planet edge on, then every time the planet passes between us and the star, it blocks a tiny little bit of the sunlight. And Kepler is sensitive enough to detect that. And it might only be 1% of the star. Actually, gosh, getting a 1% dip in the starlight's a lot. A planet like the Earth blocking a star like the sun, it's actually, I want to say, 0.01%, 0.01000th of the sunlight. And it depends on how big the planet is and how big the star is. So, you can tell how big the planet is by how much light it blocks. You can tell its period by how long it takes to pass around the star. And that tells you how far away it is from the star. You can actually get quite a bit of data looking at this. So, with that preface out of the way, what they did is they looked at 150,000 stars and said, how many of these stars are like the sun? For you know, astro nerds out there, G-type stars, or even K, which are a little bit cooler than the sun. And they sifted through the data, and they found 42,557 stars. And they said, how many planets do we see orbiting out of those 42,557 stars? And they found a little over 600. And some are big, some are small, some orbit really close to their star, some really far away. So what they did was they looked at the planets and said, how big are they? Can we tell how big they are? And the answer is yes. They looked for planets that were between 1 to 2 times the size of the Earth. So not too small and not too big. And then judging from the distance from the star, they said, we're going to limit this to planets that get between 1/4 and 4 times as much sunlight as the Earth does. So what they're saying is, sort of in what scientists call parameter space, where you can sort of list a bunch of things and say, how much do we want to fool with these numbers? They're looking for planets that are like the Earth, stars that are like the Sun, and planets that are at the right distance from their star to get roughly the same amount of sunlight as the Earth. Some of these planets may be too hot. Some of them may still be too cold. It depends if they have an atmosphere or not. We don't know if these planets have an atmosphere or not. We don't know what they're made of. Doesn't matter. We're just trying to get a really good grasp of sort of the overall picture here. And when they did that, out of those 600 planets, they found 10 planets that get between 1/4 and 4 times as much sunlight and are very much like the Earth, orbiting sun-like stars. And if you take that number and extrapolate that out to the number of stars in the galaxy and all that sort of thing, what you find is that very roughly between 1/4 and 1/5 of all sun-like stars in the galaxy should have Earth-like planets, statistically speaking. There are roughly 20 billion stars like that in the galaxy, and so 1/5 of them, 4 billion, 5 billion, something like that. There should be something like 4 or 5 billion Earth-like planets in the galaxy alone.
Was it 40?
There are 200 billion stars in the Milky Way. 10% are like the Sun, so that's 20 billion stars.
The article says 40 billion.
Yeah, the article says 40 billion.
Okay, let me put it this way. There are billions of Earth-like planets out there, or there should be, statistically speaking. That number is fairly variable depending on what kind of stars you're looking at. In fact, we know that there are planets orbiting red dwarfs, which are way more common than stars like the Sun. You know, half the stars in the sky are like that. And so when you add up all the stars in the galaxy that could have planets that are receiving the right amount of light and are planets like the Earth, you get numbers that are in the tens of billions.
So that's combining with the red dwarfs, you get to 40.
I think that's correct.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And either way, it doesn't matter. The whole point is, because we don't know exactly, and it doesn't really matter. The whole point is, the Earth is not the only Earth-like planet out there. And it's not that there are, you know, 5 or 17. There are billions of them out there.
Yeah.
So that's really amazing and very hopeful for me, I think.
We are so not alone. Phil, do you think the planets have, like, similar gravity than Earth? Or, like, how similar would you say they are?
Well, that's a really good question. This is a really neat topic because it depends on a lot of things. You can have a planet twice as big as the Earth, but it can have Earth-like gravity. It just depends on how dense it is. The surface gravity, the amount of gravity you feel when you're standing on the surface of a planet, depends on the mass and the radius. And so if you, it just kind of scales with density. So if you, you can have a bigger planet, and if you just change the mass the right way, for example, if it has, if it's made of a lighter material or a denser material, the gravity can be almost anything you want. Not so much like that, but, you know, you could easily find a planet with half the Earth's gravity up to a couple of times the Earth's gravity in this, range of planets that they're finding. So it's not like, they're looking for planets like the Earth. They don't want to find something that has 8 times the Earth's gravity or something that has 1/6 right, like the Moon does. So keeping the radius between 1 to 2 times the Earth probably keeps the gravity in that range. It won't be too strong of a surface gravity so that it can hold on to lighter elements like hydrogen or helium and turn into a gas giant. You don't want that.
You know what bothers me?
What?
Every single planet that Star Trek visited, the Enterprise visited, had exactly 1G.
Yeah.
Well,
maybe they just don't go to the other places.
I could swear.
Never.
I suppose.
No, you're right,
so,
Stephen. You know why they did it. I mean, it was...
Yeah, it's because it's cheap.
Of course.
Budget restrictions.
I could swear there was... At some point, they were on a planet, and they said, the gravity's too light to be the planet we thought we were on, or something like that. I know there's one where the sky was the wrong color, but that was because that was the Gamesters of Triskelion, because, hello, dork, but I seem to remember one about gravity, but I can't place it. Maybe I'm wrong.
There may be an exception out there, but you know, the vast majority,
yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Exactly.
Well, Steve, think about it, Steve. With billions of Earth-like planets, they could be very picky and say, we're only...
Well, I'm not talking about the...
That's what I'm saying.
I'm not talking about the ones that they colonize, but even when they have to visit a world with some aliens on it for some reason, you know, they're all 1G.
Well, it could be 0.8 or 1.2. You'd hardly notice.
Sure.
Also a good point. See? Shove it, Steve.
Yeah, really. I bet you would notice. I bet you would. I bet you would not look normal to the human eye.
Yeah, well, you'd notice, so, Phil, for sure. But I wonder how evolution would be different at 1.2, right? The trees might be more stunted, or maybe they would just develop plants might develop a better technique for reinforcing themselves against gravity. You might not get sequoias, but you'd still get, you know, willow trees or oaks or something. I don't know.
So, Phil, do you think that this might be an underestimate still because of the techniques that we're using to find planets are biased towards big worlds?
In this case, they tried to account for planets they might miss because, for example, if we're seeing the orbit face on, then the planet never passes in between us and the star. So they accounted for stuff like that. Now, your point is that the way we look for transits and some of the other methods, it's easier to see bigger Jupiter-like planets on closer-in orbits. It's very hard to find Earth-sized planets because, for one thing, they don't block that much of the starlight. And if they're far enough from the star that they're not too hot, they're on an orbital period of about a year, and it's hard to find those planets because they transit their star over the course of an hour or something like that, and that only happens once a year. It is very tough to find these kind of planets. They tried to account for all that sort of stuff. But I agree with you. I think that this is an underestimate. For one thing, again, they're just looking at sun-like stars. They were not looking at red dwarfs. We know that up to 15% of these smaller, cooler red dwarfs have an Earth-sized planet at the right distance. Hotter stars can do this as well. It's less likely for a host of reasons, but it could happen. And this would not necessarily find exomoons, for example. Moons of planets that are far enough out. You could have Europas and Enceladuses. Enceladi. Ooh, I like that. Where
Pandora.
Where they might have undersurface oceans or other things heating them. So my guess is that we will find if our technology gets this good, whether we have to go there or whether we just have gigantic telescopes 100 miles across out in space or something, we will find that, yes, this is an underestimate, and there will be far more planets out there than we thought.
Phil, I have a random astronomical question for you. Can you have you have a sun and then a planet and a moon? Can the moon have a moon?
That's a really good question. I get that one every now and again. The answer is yes. Kind of. For example, we have satellites orbiting the Earth's moon. And so you can think of those as a moon of a moon. You could have a small 1 to 10 meter rock orbiting a moon. The problem is
stability.
Depending on how you do this, the orbits typically aren't stable. You have to be close enough to the moon that the planet's gravity doesn't adversely affect that orbit. If you put a satellite around a moon, over time, the planet's gravity will poke it and push it, and eventually it'll crash into the moon. And if you put it too close to the moon, irregularities in the gravitational field, there are mountains and valleys and things under the surface, will also mess with the orbit, and eventually it'll crash. So over the lifetime of the universe, it would be unlikely. And from what we've seen in our solar system, the moons do not have moons unless we put them there. So the answer is yes, but it would be temporary over billions of years.
And are they called moons, or is there another word, or can we make one up right now?
Satellite.
Submoons.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Subsatellite?
Submoons. I don't know.
Phil, one question for me about this. So now we know what to look for, where these planets are. We've identified them. Now what are the signatures that we should start looking for as far as, evidence of any sort of intelligent life?
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of clever ways of doing that. SETI is looking for radio signals.
Methane in the atmospheres?
Methane's an interesting one. A lot of the planets have methane in their atmospheres. Saturn, Jupiter, Uranus, Neptune. So methane is unstable under certain circumstances, like on Earth. And our atmosphere is fundamentally different than those gas giants. But methane is relatively unstable. It tends to combine with things. So if you see an atmosphere of, say, a terrestrial planet, something small like the Earth that's also warm, methane would be very unlikely, unless it's, incredibly geologically active. So seeing methane wouldn't necessarily be proof of life, but it would be interesting. If you saw methane if you saw oxygen, O2, like in our atmosphere, O2 is incredibly reactive, and it's got a lifetime that's incredibly short. So if it's out of equilibrium, in other words, if you just stick oxygen in an atmosphere and let the planet sit, and in 100 years it should all be gone. But on Earth it's not, because we have a supply of it from plants. So if you saw that, that would be a much stronger indicator. The only thing is, the universe is very tricksy, And I don't necessarily, you know, if we saw O2, I would be very excited. But I would say that the universe is very clever, and it might come up with a way of producing O2 that we hadn't thought of. I'd like to have a series of indications of life rather than just like one or two. But who knows? You know, we've got James Webb Space Telescope going up. It'll be able to detect lots of interesting things, signatures of chemicals and other planets. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay, I've named a planet's moon's moon. We shall forever call them a Moony Moo Moo.
No.
Okay.
That's going to catch on.
That's not the next moon.
Moonlet.
Moonlet's not bad.
Moonlet's already in use for tiny moons. You guys are going to have a hard time getting that past the IAU, the International Astronomical Union.
Moony Moo Moo. We're going to move on to a couple of items dealing with our own solar system. Very quickly, this one's about the new images of Saturn from NASA. They're absolutely stunning.
So the Cassini spacecraft's been orbiting Saturn now for, it's getting close to a decade. Pretty amazing. It's been over 9 years. And it's, you know, it's been returning all these fantastic images. And in 2006, it took this amazing mosaic of Saturn. It was on an orbit that took it, an elliptical orbit that took it kind of far out. And it was on the night side of Saturn. So they took this mosaic, a series of pictures, that they put together. And it was this gorgeous backlit picture of Saturn. Well, they looked at it and said, this is great, and it's scientifically useful, but it was kind of an accident. It's beautiful, but they didn't plan it to be beautiful. They just kind of planned it for scientific purposes. So they said, let's do this again. Carolyn Porco basically said, the imaging team leader for Cassini, basically said, let's do this again, but do it right and take it using the right filters and the right combination, and then put these together and release the image. And so in July of 2013, July 19th, I believe it was, over a course of 4 hours, it took over 100 pictures using red, green, and blue filters of Saturn when basically Saturn was between Cassini and the sun. So Cassini was on the night side of Saturn looking up at it at a slight angle, a 17-degree angle, I believe. It's taken them a while to put these pictures together because they were very careful. And they're spectacular. It's gorgeous. It's this incredible picture. I mean, I'm sure the listeners have seen it. If they haven't, I've got it on my blog. You can find it all over the place. You can see the Saturn disk. It's silhouetted because you're looking over the night side of the planet. You're looking through the rings. You're not looking at the directly illuminated rings. The sun is behind them. So they're looking kind of shadowy and cool. You can see a bunch of moons, including Enceladus with its geysers of water blasting out of the South Pole. A lot of interesting features in the rings and on the planet itself. But one of the things that's really, really cool about this is just to the lower right of Saturn is the Earth. You can see it as a tiny dot. And not only that, you can see the moon next to the Earth. It's pretty amazing. Mars and Venus are in this picture as well. And it's just phenomenal. There's a ton of stuff going on. I describe it on my blog. Emily Lakdawala, my pal over at the Planetary Society blog, has a video tour of the image where she actually describes what you're seeing. I would highly recommend going to the Planetary Society blog and taking a look at that, because she's really thorough and goes over what's going on in the picture. It's really gorgeous.
Yeah, it's cool. You could download the full images from the NASA site, and they even have ones that are labeled, like, so all the moons are labeled, everything you could see in the picture. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's 9,000 by 3,500 pixels. So there you go.
Right.
Wow. I thought this was a fake picture the first time I saw it. It was an unbelievable shot, right? I mean, I don't know. Does anyone be able to feel that? Like, this is not real?
Yeah, it does. It does. It looks photoshopped.
Well, wow, it is. I mean, does. It's just not created from whole cloth, right?
It's a composite.
It's starting with actual data, and then they overlapped the pictures and did all kinds of manipulation. Nothing they did is faking the image, really. They're just putting them together to make it pretty.
It's gorgeous. Yeah, that's definitely one of the best astronomy pictures of the year.
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. It's really worth getting the big one because you can see stars in the background. There are some really faint features in the rings. There was a ring that I didn't even know existed, created by a tiny little moon that's just a few kilometers across. It's basically an icy moon that gets hit by meteoroids, you know, little asteroids in space, that blasts off chunks of ice. And so there's this little ringlet that this moon basically creates. And I'd never even heard of that before. So it's pretty amazing to download the big image and take a long, careful look at it. It's phenomenal.
Another cool image, although not as high res, is the six-tailed asteroid. Very interesting how that comes to be. I was reading a lot about it. You know, it's still a little bit mysterious exactly what's generating those six tails.
Yeah, this is an interesting object. It's out in the main asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, and it's called P2013P5. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, huh, because the first P is usually reserved for comets. P stands for periodic. And so when it was discovered, I knew right away that when it was discovered, it already had these weird tails. Instead of something that's like being some asteroid we've known about for a long time that then developed tails. In fact, it was discovered by a survey with these tails coming out of it. Not just like one, but it has six. And it looks like a comet with six tails. So it was given this cometary name. Well, it turns out it is, in fact, an asteroid. It's a rocky body. It's probably not that big. It's probably something like a kilometer or two across, you know, roughly a mile. Why does it have tails? Well, we're not exactly sure. This does happen sometimes. Asteroids can collide, and you get basically a spray of material coming off of them, but not six. So something else must be going on. And what they think happened here, maybe, and this fits what we're seeing, is if you take an asteroid and put it out in sunlight and you let it spin, right? Or just for a second, ignore the spin. Just put it out in sunlight. Half of it's in sunlight, half of it's dark. So half of it's warm and half of it's cold. Now, if you let it spin, the hot side, the sunward side, will then rotate into the dark side and radiate away its heat. And that's just, you know, that's how things get rid of their heat out in space. They radiate away as infrared light. Well, light has momentum. Even though a particle of light has no mass, part of quantum mechanics, part of relativity, is that light has a certain amount of momentum. So when these photons of infrared light bling off the asteroid, pew, they shoot away, they carry away a little bit of the asteroid's momentum, a little bit of the spin. And it turns out, depending on whether the asteroid's lumpy or whatever, it can either add or subtract to the asteroid's spin over time. In this case, what they think happened is this thing is got a loose surface. It's kind of a dusty, rocky surface, and it's been spinning faster over time due to this effect, which is the YORP effect. It stands for four very long Slavic names, which I can't remember off the top of my head. But basically, this thing has been spinning faster and faster over time, and eventually it got so fast that it started flinging material off its surface, and it's had several of these episodes where basically maybe there was a landslide and stuff has been flung off the surface over the past few months. And that's what we're seeing. Pretty amazing.
Normally, an asteroid wouldn't have a tail because anything that's in the solar system, in the inner solar system, that had anything that would evaporate away and create a tail should already be gone. It's only because comets are coming into the inner solar system with their ice and dust, you know, that they generate a tail. So this is something must have changed about this asteroid not too long ago.
That's it exactly, yes. A comet and an asteroid are very similar, except a comet has a lot of ice in it. Water, ice, ammonia, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, things like that. When it gets near the sun, that stuff heats up and blows off the surface and forms the fuzzy head and the long tail of the comet. But comets come in with only a certain amount of gas in their tank, literally, and eventually they run out of this stuff and they just become rock and they just, you know, orbit the sun. They look more like asteroids. They're dead comets. In this case, you've got something orbiting out on a nice stable orbit out past Mars. It's probably not a dead comet, and it's clearly not dead because there's stuff coming off of it. If this asteroid had ice on it, it would seem like a really weird coincidence that we happen to find it right as some event makes it blow off this ice. So that seems unlikely. It seems much more likely that it's been spun up, and we know that this effect works. We've seen it work on other asteroids. And I found the name. It's called the Yarkovsky-O'Keefe-Radziejewski-Paddock effect, which is why it's called YORP, Y-O-R-P.
It's memorable.
Yeah, cool. It's quite the mouthful. But there you go. I mean, this is a quantum mechanic effect operating in the macroscopic world over time. Don't tell Deepak Chopra this.
Yeah.
You know, when I saw the picture, I had a weird half a second where I saw the picture and read the title. And just for a second, I was thinking, oh, wow, this could be like an alien artifact, some alien ship that's malfunctioning. Of course, it was very fleeting, but it was a very fun half second.
They're venting plasma.
Yeah.
They're about to eject their warp core.
You're adorable, Bob.
Yeah. Well, Phil, speaking of Deepak Chopra.
Oh, God.
Yeah, Quantum.
He's been on a tear attacking skeptics recently.
Really?
A rash?
He doesn't like us, apparently. Yeah, he wrote two articles, part one and part two, where he is attacking what he calls militant skepticism.
Ten hut.
Yeah. So for those who may not know, Deepak Chopra is a physician who has published many books and has been promoting this notion of quantum healing. Essentially what he has been doing is taking Indian mysticism, you know, that there's some universal consciousness, that the universe itself is conscious, and that our human consciousness is somehow part of this, that it's not purely material or part of the brain. And he has been trying to sell this Eastern mysticism as New Age pseudoscience, and is, you know, trying to justify it with quantum mechanical language and completely abusing quantum mechanics. The end result is that he comes out with, and we've joked about him on the show before, he comes out with these sort of flowery platitudes that are ultimately meaningless. In any case, he doesn't like skeptics because we call him on his bullshit, basically. And he wrote two articles which amount to trying to marginalize scientific skeptical criticism of his views. He does that partly by conflating skepticism with atheism. You know, he says, talks about skeptics, but then as examples of skeptics, he talks about Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, the God delusion and the end of faith, and their attack, their discussions of religion as if that is skepticism, as if he's completely oblivious of, you know, the philosophical discussions that have been taking place within the skeptical movement about our relationship to philosophically to faith-based claims or claims that are outside the realm of science, etc. Not to open that whole can of worms, but, you know, Chopra just seems to completely oblivious about the whole thing. It just conflates it all as militant skepticism. He does that, you know, he sets up a bunch of straw men about what skeptics are and what skeptics say, and then, you know, knocks those down. And all for the purpose of defending, essentially injecting supernaturalism, mysticism, universal consciousness into science. So, for example, he says that there are four things that science cannot explain and not only undermines the materialist assumptions of science, but completely obliterates skepticism.
Is it how bumblebees can fly even though they're so fat? Yeah, right. Saw that on a Facebook repost once.
So, well, what do you guys think? I don't know if you read the article or my post about it, but what do you guys think they are? Four pillars of Chopra's mysticism.
Love.
So, two of them are basically quantum mechanics, you know?
Yeah, that's a gimmick.
Quantum and mechanics.
Yeah.
So, something that scientists came up with,
yeah, exactly,
and are studying is right. Something right. That disproves science.
No, it's wherever things that's get right. Fuzzy, wherever we don't have a clear answer for something, like, you know, it's
right, something we haven't figured out yet.
Yeah, exactly. He's looking at the edges of our scientific advance and then saying
the gaps.
Yeah, it's a mysticism of the gaps argument. So, you know, basically he said the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is what he means.
God.
You know, it's like beyond the limits of science, and here there be dragons, and just sort of quantum weirdness. And then the third one is the origin of space and time. You know, we can't explain where space and time came from.
Therefore,
science is limited. It's broken.
That actually, it really drives home how far scientific progress has come. Because, you know, if that's where opponents of science have to go, like, well, you don't know where everything came from. Like, that's pretty hardcore. We're doing a pretty good job figuring things out if that's, like, the big question that's left.
Yeah. It reminds me of evolution.
It used to be lightning and sickness. It's like, well, yeah, we're past that. We know how that works.
You can't tell me why those crops failed. It must have been witches. Oh, well, you can't tell me what came before the Big Bang. It must have been witches.
Yeah. It's exactly right. It's just an extrapolation of that exact same process. And then the fourth one is consciousness.
Whoa. Oh, God, what do you know about that, Steve?
Oh, yeah. So this is like, right.
Duality.
Yeah. It's a whole dualism thing. So the notion that Oh, we have no idea where consciousness comes from. So this is what he writes. The whole issue of consciousness, long ignored because of science's aversion to subjectivity, straw man, has become a major concern, principally for two reasons. The assumption that the brain is the producer of the mind has never been proved. Therefore, it presents the possibility of being wrong. Second, if consciousness is more like a field effect than a unique human trait, the universe itself could be conscious, or at least possess the qualities of proto-consciousness, just as DNA possesses the possibility of Homo sapiens, even at the stage when life forms were only single-celled organisms.
And if my grandma had wheels, she'd be a wagon.
Deepak should not be able to use the phrase could be anymore, because he obviously does not know what it means.
So the first thing he says is that we haven't proved that the brain causes consciousness. That's just wrong.
Yeah.
That's as proven a scientific theory as anything else, you know, as evolution, as plate tectonics, as gravity, whatever. Pretty much every prediction that flows from the hypothesis that the brain is the mind, that the mind is the functioning of the brain, is what we observe. Now, of course, Chopra, like other consciousness pseudoscientists, will say, yeah, but what about ESP? You know, well, yeah, come back to me when ESP is actually demonstrated with some actual science. And then he goes on to say, now, what if it's a field effect? So in other words, he's saying, if I'm right, then I could be right. If we take as a premise that my whole mysticism is true, then my mysticism could be true. That's essentially
like
what he says.
I can't argue with that.
Like a Higgs field? Is that what he's kind of
It's just a way of saying in science-y terms the universal consciousness, which is his brand of mysticism.
He could have said anything. What if rainbows are conscious? I get this a lot in astronomy as well, when people say, I saw a UFO in this picture, and you know, I can measure how big it is. And if it's even 100 miles away, it must be a mile across. And it's like, or it's a foot away and it's a dust mote, right? So as soon as you say, if it's only, or if only, or just even if, when you're making stuff up, you know, if consciousness is a rainbow, if consciousness is a box of kittens, it would be adorable, but it would be no less accurate than saying if consciousness is a field. That doesn't even make sense.
Jay, this is his religion, to answer your question. This is his creationism. That's why he cares. He's also making millions of dollars off of it, but still, this is his religion.
Well, that's,
You know, and I want to note that people talk about, you know, what science can't explain. And I think, well, you know, science doesn't claim to explain everything. Science is based on evidence. It's based on observations. And at some level, sure, of course there are things science can't explain, but it's not like that's a failing of science. To say we can't explain something just means we may not know why, but we know how. You know, we kind of understand the Heisenberg uncertainty principle at this point, at least to the ability that our entire, you know, nation's economy depends on it in computers and communication and all of that. So we know how it works quite well, thank you. As to why the universe behaves this way, the answer is we don't know that. It could behave a different way. If you had a different set of parameters in the early universe, things could be different now. But that doesn't mean we need to turn to nonsense and rhetoric that is completely unsubstantive. I mean, it's word salad. He picks words out of the air and applies his own definitions to them, and then goes, wow, this is deep. And it's like, it's not really deep. It's actually meaningless. It's kind of the opposite of deep.
Do you guys ever question whether or not he really is just making it up and likes the sound of his voice? You know, it really does seem to be so similar to that. You just don't know.
I think he believes
it.
I think he's absolutely convinced himself that what he's saying is 100%
correct.
Yeah,
he's seen so deep. To have to backpedal at this point, even in the face of evidence, it's just not going to happen.
A lot of people who start off not believing it, say a con man, for example, over time, sometimes they can convince themselves that what they're saying is true. I'm not saying that's what Chopra is doing. I'm not saying that's what anybody's doing. I'm just saying that has happened. So at some level, it's almost a difference that makes no difference is no difference. Whether he believes it or not isn't really clear. The fact is,
he's wrong. I agree.
And he's been doing this a long time. I just searched my own blog. I've been debunking his baloney since 2009 at least, where he's been attacking skeptics for no reason. You're right, Steve. I mean, if you read what Chopra says, it's always a straw man argument against skeptics.
Always.
He doesn't really understand how science or skepticism works.
Exactly. Let me give you a few more examples of how absolutely clueless he is. He says that negativity, meaning referring to skeptics, has never accomplished anything. That's a fundamental misunderstanding.
That's what science
is all about. Exactly. One of my commenters says,
Dr. Chopra.
That's like saying to a sculptor, well, chipping away stone doesn't accomplish anything. It's taking stuff away.
That's a great metaphor.
Yeah, it is.
So negative.
So science, is about separating out the bullshit. That's about proving stuff wrong. You know, that is, it completely misses that. And then here's a quickie summary for him of militant skeptics. He says, militant skeptics who are wedded to an outmoded belief that the five senses are basically reliable, that only physical things are real, and that pure objectivity is possible, with the corollary that subjectivity will always be the enemy of real science. Wow. He packed in the straw man so tight there.
Yeah. I don't think any of that is correct.
No, none of it is true. And then, you could just peruse any of our blogs, Phil or Rebecca or me, or listen to the show. And how many times do we talk about the fact that our senses are not reliable? Yeah. That, reality is constructed. Our perceptions of reality are constructed. That, and that physical things are real, that's a meaningless statement. There's no way to interpret that's not nonsensical. Right? Clearly energy is real, and energy is not physical in the way that matter is real, so that's kind of silly. And if he's talking about everything in the universe, then he essentially is saying that real things are real.
Nothing unreal exists.
Yes, Deepak, we believe that only real things are real. Got us.
Look at dark energy. Right. Three-fourths of the entire universe is something that's, I'm sure, I don't think it's physical. It's some sort of weird energy, but I mean, oh my God.
I thought that's where he was going to go with the fourth pillar. I didn't even think of the consciousness. I thought he might bring up dark energy.
A guy that has talked to some of the brightest minds that we know. He's debated them. He has, from my perspective, been shown to be so ignorant. And he sits there, unwavering, as if none of the criticism or facts or logic that touch him matter in any way, and he just keeps going and going, and nothing stops this guy.
Yeah, he doesn't care. He's not engaging. He's not engaging with anyone, of any weight, right? I mean, he's completely untouched by the backlash against his nonsensical posts, articles, multiple skeptics correcting his complete mischaracterization of what skepticism is. He's not engaging. He's intellectually bankrupt. He's intellectually dishonest, in my opinion. He's not trying to really understand what's going on.
He makes these empty gestures of being engaged, like, seeming to engage with people like Leonard Blonde now. And it makes me really frustrated when I see people like Milan now and other respected scientists giving him time and giving him some amount of respectability that he just does not deserve.
Credibility.
At all.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
I can understand wanting to reach out to his audience, but I mean, Deepak himself has just gone.
That's a great point, Rebecca. And it's funny that you would say that, because I was dealing with this today. There are times when it's worth it to engage somebody who disagrees with you, even if what they're disagreeing with is on the fundamentals of the argument itself, like, for example, evidence-based reasoning. On the other hand, it's quite clear that Chopra is intractable. He's never going to change his mind. I would never bother dealing with him directly, debating him or going on a TV show with him or something like that, because it's worthless, at least to change his mind. Unless it were a completely neutral medium. And I happened to be dealing with this today because I got sucked into a dumb argument with somebody about climate change. And, it's like, if you were being intellectually honest, intellectually fair, and were willing to look at the evidence, that's one thing. But if you're just screaming conspiracy or whatever, or something like that, it's clear it's not worth my time at all to jump in. And so I agree with you. I find it disappointing when people do this as well. Clearly, Chopra's not going to change his mind. I don't think it's going to have any sort of real effect on his audience. And it's probably better to try to create an atmosphere of more skeptical, evidence-based people so that eventually people like Chopra don't have an audience anymore.
All right. Well, one more quick news item. We do want to mention the fact that recently, as we're recording this, a massive typhoon hit the Philippines. Typhoon Haiyan. Is that how you pronounce it? Haiyan? It has killed thousands of people. I don't think they're anywhere near an accurate estimate at the time we're recording, but it's at least in the thousands of people and millions homeless. The islands are devastated. If you look at pictures, it's just rubble, you know, from horizon to horizon with bodies, you know, mixed in there. And people are not getting food, not getting water. They don't have shelter. It's very hot, and they're without access to water. They're in the midst now of an epidemic of people getting dysentery from contaminated water. It's a really terrible scene there.
Yeah, and you know, I just today actually I got an email from Red Tani, who's the founder and president of the Filipino Free Thinkers, and I want to mention that they're going to be doing a fundraising web show on the weekend, November 30th to December 1st. And I don't have a URL or anything for you right now, but they're just putting it together as I speak. So we'll update events.skeptic.org with info on how you can get involved in that if you want to donate and support them.
Yeah, there's also another charity going on. The CFI hosts their Secular and Skeptical charity, and they are now directing funds to support the Philippines, the Typhoon Haiyan efforts. So we'll have the link in the show notes there if you want to donate through them.
It's also known as Typhoon Yolanda in the Philippines, for what it's worth.
That's what they're calling it?
Yeah, I don't know why we don't just call it Yolanda.
I don't know.
I don't understand.
And also, this has raised the question yet again, is to what extent, if any, is global warming to blame for the severity of this typhoon? And there is evidence, actually, not that we've made this mistake on the show before. It doesn't increase the number of such storms, hurricanes or typhoons, but it may increase their maximal intensity. The oceans are a little higher, a little bit warmer, and there is recent evidence that the top wind speeds have been increasing of storms like this.
That's right. And I want to jump in here because, of course, this is one of the things I write about sometimes. When I wrote about Haiyan the first time, I said, look, you know, it's very tempting to jump in and say global warming made this such a super typhoon, such a huge cyclone. And it is, as far as we know, the most intense cyclone that's ever hit land in recorded history. There have been some other ones that have been very strong and very close, but nothing like this. The question is, did global warming do this? And you have to be careful, because it's really impossible to say that any one event is due to global warming, period. It's more like global warming is an environment in which certain, you know, potentials can be fostered. And as you mentioned, Steve, for example, there was a paper that came out a few years ago that showed that for the most intense cyclones, the ones with the strongest winds, the top speeds of the winds have been increasing over time. That the top speeds of these winds have increased and increased substantially, measurably. It's not that there have been more storms, and it's not that every storm has gotten stronger. It's just that for the most powerful ones, the winds have increased. And this is, all things being equal, that's probably due to warmer water. And the warmer water is coming from probably global warming. You can't just say Haiyan was big because of global warming, but it's that environment that it's in. So you have to be careful about that. But as you mentioned, hurricanes do a lot of damage through the storm surge. And storm surge is basically a wave of water in the eye that comes sweeping ashore. And that's very sensitive to sea levels. And the Philippines has had a lot of sea level rise over the past few decades. And that is from global warming, because as you warm the water up, it expands. So sea levels are rising not necessarily just because the poles are melting, but also because warm water just is a little bit more voluminous than cold water. That damage can be attributed at least to global warming. So you just have to be careful how you phrase it. It's an environment in which all of these things sit. It's the way you look at stuff. But trying to attribute, you know, effect A to cause B can be a little difficult.
All right. Well, Phil, I understand you have to leave us.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Not one of these four-hour marathon interviews this time.
Yeah, it was always great to have you on the show.
It's always great to be here. It really is. And I'm not just saying that because I like you guys.
We miss you when you're not here.
Oh.
Is there some place that people can see you? Any live events you're doing coming up?
Not in time for this broadcast, but it's easy enough to find me online, of course, the Bad Astronomy blog at slate.com. And you can go to sciencegetaways.com, where my wife and I do science vacations. And I will plug my nerd insult book with Zach Wiener from Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal and Jess Fink, who illustrated it. We just put that up on Amazon and Smashwords. So it's much easier to get at now. And the holidays are coming.
cool. plug. All right, Phil, take care.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Phil.
See you, buddy.
Later,
take care,
brother.
B.A.
All right, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
It is, and what we're going to do is play for you the new Who's That Noisy this week, and next week we're going to have two reveals, which means for those listening to last week's Noisy, we're extending the time in which you can go ahead and submit your answer. So here we go, this week's brand new Who's That Noisy. Enjoy.
The new Mountain Goats album.
So go ahead and submit your answer via email, wtn@theskepticsguide.org, or feel free to leave your answer as a post on our forums, sguforums.com. Next week we will have a double reveal. Good luck, everyone.
All righty. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
All right. Our first email this week is a Name That Logical Fallacy. You guys ready for this? This comes from Albany, New York. And the writer writes, I can't seem to categorize what fallacy this might be. Let's say Jay tells Bob that Steve is going to lie to him tonight. Then Steve tells Bob something which is true, but Bob says, aha, I know not to believe you because Jay already told me you were going to lie. For me, this came in the form of childhood indoctrination and being told that my religious views were the truth and that people who believe other things had been deceived, therefore I knew not to believe them. It wasn't until my 20s that I began to realize I actually had no idea which side of the fence I was on. I had been trusting my peers, so I might say it was something like an appeal to authority, but I feel like it has more to do with thinking that you have advanced knowledge of an oncoming lie, and that causing you to disregard the contradictory information without pause. I think that there are many variations of this, from conspiracy theories to the tactics of con artists. I just don't know how to classify it.
That's called Routine 19.
Routine 19, that's right. Any other names you might want to attach to it?
What?
Well, it's
I don't know that reference either.
Yeah, I don't. What's Routine 19?
That's what my dad used to say when someone was giving him the old runaround, you know, like
the old Hucklebuck.
Oh,
yeah.
I love that.
Oh, the old Hucklebuck. Why didn't you say so?
That's what that is. So, yeah, to our email, that is called the old Hucklebuck.
I love that. I love it.
All right. So my first thought was poisoning the well, right?
I was thinking poisoning the well or ad hominem. Which is similar. Attacking the source.
What about a false premise?
Well, sure. Yes, it is a false premise in that, but the premise though is that the other person is a liar or is part of the conspiracy or is the mouthpiece of Satan or, you know, take your pick depending on your belief system. It's essentially a mechanism in order to lock somebody into a closed belief system by telling them that anyone who disagrees with the belief system is part of the conspiracy or is from Satan.
Untrustworthy.
Or lacks faith or whatever, you know, or they're liars is the simplest thing to say about it. So, yeah, I do think the sort of the ad hominem poisoning the well sort of axis captures that because you're just doing it in advance, you know, in order to undercut the credibility of the other person so that they won't be listened to. But it is a very common tactic of creating the closed belief system that, you know, is not uncommon to many religions, many conspiracy theories, many cults, etc. All right, one more. So I'm not going to read a specific email, but there were a few people who, actually 2 weeks ago, we talked about the the fact that in our interview with Chris Mooney and Indre, that all animals get cancer, that this notion that animals don't get cancer is silly, that it's not due to industrial poisoning, it's just life, you know, things get cancer. Several people commented on the forums or on email, hey, what about naked mole rats?
Yeah.
I heard that naked mole rats never get cancer. So, sounds interesting. I did a deep dive on this question, and what do you think I found?
That if they wear clothes, they don't get cancer.
Undetermined.
I guess that they do.
They die before they get cancer.
What I found, doing as deep a dive as I could in the literature, is that the naked mole rat and the blind mole rat do not get cancer.
Wow.
For as long as any of them have been observed in a, you know, laboratory setting, there hasn't been a single incidence, even with thousands of animals being observed for years, of any of them getting cancer. To the point that...
Are we giving them, like, lots of Diet Coke? Because
yeah.
I've heard...
So that's a really good question, actually. So what if you try to give them cancer, what happens?
Yeah.
So this there's an entire research program trying to figure out why these mole rats, you know, the, you know, naked mole rats and blind mole rats, why they don't get cancer. They are considered highly cancer resistant. You know, you don't want to say immune because your observations are always finite. Just there are no known documented cases. So, I found a couple of interesting things. One study looking at the blind mole rat found that they're fibroblasts. So fibroblasts are like basic cells of your connective tissue. You know, it's like when you cut yourself and then a scar forms to heal the cut, that's fibroblasts moving into the wound and, you know, propagating and forming the scar tissue. That the fibroblasts of the blind mole rat, they actually surround cancer cells and inhibit their growth and spread.
Sweet.
That the fibroblasts are much less tolerant of crowding than, say, the fibroblasts of mice. Now, mice get tumors easily. Most mice will die of tumors. I didn't know that. They're really prone to getting tumors. And mice live to be, you know, several years. Mole rats live to be
10.
34 years.
Whoa.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
And
that's,
I think it's
amazing.
Yeah, for naked mole rats, it's like 35 years or so. And for blind mole rats, it's like 20 something years. So they live much longer.
I'm getting a mole rat.
And even though they live much longer, so they don't die before they get tumors, they live a really long time because they don't get tumors, partly. So one of the answers is their fibroblasts seem to actually inhibit the growth of tumors. Another study found that their genetics are different, that whereas, like, in the mouse, a single mutation of a specific gene will cause a tumor, in the mole rat, the same mutation in that gene will not, because of other genetic variants that they have. So in essence, you would need to get several mutations at the same time in order for a tumor to occur. So their genetics conspire to make it less likely. You know, no single mutation will do it. You need a host of mutations. And then the third answer that I found, this is now a study in the naked mole rat, was that their fibroblasts, maybe this may explain one way in which the fibroblasts suppress tumors, they produce a lot of hyaluronic acid, which is normal. It's something that fibroblasts produce in mammals, that this maybe what is suppressing the spread and the growth of tumor cells.
Now, can I buy that online from a Chinese pharmacy?
It's something that your own cells have to make. You know, just eating it's not going to help you.
I'm not asking whether it'll help me.
Yeah.
I'm asking whether or not I can buy it yet and whether or not Dr. Oz is promoting it.
I see. Because you want to resell it with claims that it will
yes.
cure your cancer. Now, of course, every article, every popular article, not the scientific articles, about to say this may help us, you know, cure cancer in the future. And of sure, you know, discovering how the mole rats prevent themselves from getting cancer may lead to something which can be, you know, help us treat cancer. But, you know, it's that they evolved this way. So, like with the hyaluronic acid, for example, that also is what gives them their kind of funky skin. You know, it not only is it naked, but it's wrinkly and ugly. So that may be the trade-off. You know, you may need to have ugly skin in order
Let's hold the value judgments, all right?
In order to have, whatever, you know, by human subjective standards. in order to be, you know, have that kind of resistance.
That's going
to
be the new sexy. Are you kidding?
Sure.
living cancer free, but super wrinkly.
Yeah.
I'm going to start selling mole rat juice.
Naked mole rat juice.
That look,
you're just
going to
blend them up.
It won't be real naked mole rat juice. I'm just going to call it that.
Oh.
So I was really surprised. I'm like, I set out to say, oh, this is BS. I'm sure it's exaggerated. I'm going to find some report somewhere of a mole rat with cancer. I couldn't find it. Every reference I found said, nope, there's no cases known. And there's actually multiple lines of research showing that they have evolved pretty effective anti-cancer strategies.
These buggers live to 34, Steve. So that means they may not have many natural enemies either. I mean,
Well, they're underground, you know.
Well, they're underground, but they're
the naked mole rat it's also one of the few mammals that they basically have a female queen, and then there's a bunch of males that live in service to the lone female queen of the colony.
I want to be a mole rat.
Yeah,
that's what I've decided.
I'm shocked.
What animal would you be if you could be any animal? Mole rat.
Naked.
A naked mole rat.
Yeah, naked.
Naked as a jaybird.
And guess what their closest living relative is?
The jaybird?
An animal we talked about recently.
The porcupine.
Oh,
damn.
No, the quill pig. The porcupine is also known as a quill pig. Did you know that? Not a whistle pig.
No.
That's what porcupine That's awesome. Means, quill pig.
Every animal has a name that includes the name pig, actually.
Yeah. We're long pigs.
Humans are bipedal pigs.
No, we're long pigs. We are long pigs.
Long pigs.
But a quill pig will get cancer, I guess. So.
Yes, but not a naked mole rat.
So basically it's relative.
So anyway, very interesting. This is one that surprised me.
Yeah.
Wow.
But very cool.
It's time for science or fiction.
It's time to play science or fiction.
It's a little retro there, Evan.
Who are you?
I don't know. I think got too close to a wormhole or something. I don't know. Science. A game we play every week in which Steve usually gives us the rogues a bunch of questions, several of which are science, but one is fictitious, one is a fake, and is up to us, the rogues, to figure out which item is the fake. However, this week, Steve is going to be playing, and I will be hosting the game. So I wish you all the best of luck.
Thanks, Evan.
Here we go.
Thank you.
There is not a theme this week.
Yay.
But all three items do have something in common. I did that for Rebecca's sake.
By definition, that's a theme.
I was just trying to soften the blow for Rebecca because she's not all that into themes, right?
Don't complain. At least there is a theme. Three options.
There is a theme. This week's theme is bacteria.
Evan!
Bacteria.
Uh-huh. Ooh.
Who here likes bacteria? Come on. Put your hands together for bacteria. Let's go. Item number one. A new study suggests that a bacteria found in a turnip might prevent the flu, and human clinical trials are happening right now. Item number two. Scientists have reportedly succeeded in killing a bacteria using a protein taken from a virus. Item number three. Researchers have shown that bacteria released from the scent glands of a hyena leaves detailed information about the hyena, information equivalent to what you would read on a person's Facebook profile. Rebecca is going to go first today. Rebecca.
All right. I have not heard of any of these, so good job, Evan.
Thank you.
These are all a complete mystery to me.
Excellent.
Because of that, I want to play the psychological game here. A bacteria found in turnip might prevent the flu. That's weird. That's a weird thing that I've never heard. Could it be true? Yes. I suppose, yeah. Killing a bacteria using a protein taken from a virus also seems plausible because I've heard of researchers looking into the use of viruses as ways to combat diseases and things. So, yeah, why not? Why couldn't a virus kill a bacteria or a protein from a virus kill a bacteria? The scent glands of a hyena leaving detailed information like what you would find on a Facebook profile. So this is where I realized that I was going to be playing the psychological game because that is tailor-made from a press release sent from a university, I'm sure, to a newspaper outlet and printed as is. Like, that sounds exactly like something that exists. Like, let's use the idea of Facebook. Kids love Facebook. Let's use that as a way to get people to pay attention to this weird thing about hyenas sniffing each other. So that one I think is definitely true. And so if I'm playing that game, the turnip thing is so bizarre that seems like maybe that one's true as well. The only one that's kind of bland and seems like it's trying to quietly pass under the radar is this thing about using protein from a virus to kill a bacteria. There's no turnips involved. There's no social networks involved. It's a very quiet, unassuming item. And for that reason, I believe that it is the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Rebecca made a lot of sense.
Really?
But I will take these one by one, okay? The one about the study that suggests that bacteria in a turnip could prevent the flu. Wow, that's a big claim. That's a very big claim. And, you know, like Rebecca said, you know, bacteria doing something to a virus is definitely a novelty idea, but I don't think that it's impossible. But I just think if that hit the news, I think that in the time while I was sitting here, it would have come up on my computer screen. Not that I'm looking at the news right now. I'm just saying. Okay, next one about the killing bacteria using a protein taken from a virus, which isn't that the exact opposite of the first one?
Yeah, you could look at it that way, I suppose.
Yeah, this one is underwhelming in its lack of information. Sure, okay, I'm pretty sure that it's not impossible, but you know, there's nothing really here to sink my teeth into. Just this is what's going on. So that one I have to put in limbo real quick. And then the last one is the bacteria that released from the scent glands and all that. I think that one is definitely science. I know that there's a novelty thing there about the Facebook profile, but I always kind of thought that when a dog was like smelling the pee spot of another dog, that's kind of like them reading the newspaper. Remember that, Bob?
Yep.
We used to say that Bocce was out reading the newspaper when he was like rolling around smelling all the pee spots everywhere. So, okay, being that one is science in my mind, and it's between one and two, and I think that two is phenomenally underwhelming, so I'm going to say that one's the fake. That's the one about the bacteria killing the virus.
Okay, thank you, Jay. Bob.
Well, yeah, the turnip one does seem bizarre, and why, you know, why would a bacteria that's in a turnip happen to help prevent the flu? That one doesn't seem right to me. And the third one as well, the whole Facebook thing, just seems too manufactured for appeal. So I agree with Rebecca on that one. And the thing is, though, two might make the most sense to me, and because I know that viruses combat bacteria routinely. I mean, that's just one of the things that they do, I'm pretty sure. So the fact that they did this is not too surprising to me. But I do also agree how number two seems anomalous compared to the other two. But screw it. I'm going to just go with my gut and not use psychology, but just use my what I know of some science that I'm going to go with the turnip one. Say that's fiction.
Okay, Bob, thank you. And last, certainly not least, Stephen Novella.
Yeah, I had, you know, actually had the exact same reaction that Rebecca did to these items. The third one does read like a silly kind of press release. Evan, if you faked that, good for you, because you got us all, because I'm going to say that one is science. So for me, it was between one and two, you know, bacteria killing a virus or virus killing a bacteria. Both are completely plausible. Yeah, bacteria to prevent the flu, it's a probiotic. Yeah, human trials are ongoing. The number of things that suggest that there may be an effect is so massive that it's hard to say that one's implausible. And again, the way that one's worded, new study suggests, you know, that seems like the kind of thing that would be reported. You know, killing a bacteria, what, in a petri dish? You can kill a bacteria with all sorts of ways. You know, using a protein that they got from a virus, that's very, very mundane. So the biggest thing going against that is that it's not reported in a way that sounds like it's a science news item. It absolutely could be, but I do have to just go with the wording there to say that one protein from a virus killing the bacteria, I'll agree that that one is a fiction.
Okay. So, therefore, we're going to take these in reverse order because none of you think that the fiction is the one that reads, researchers have shown that bacteria released from the scent glands of a hyena leaves detailed information about the hyena, information equivalent to what you would read on a person's Facebook profile. You all think this is science, and this one is science.
Yes.
Yes.
Bacteria powering the social lives of hyenas. Bacteria residing in the scent glands
like.
Of bacteria residing in the scent glands of spotted and striped hyenas appear to play a crucial role in producing the smelly chemicals the animal uses to communicate, according to the new study. So what they do is it gets secreted as part of their, you know, through their scent glands. So the scent comes out, and also comes out is this paste, is how they describe it. Disgusting.
Ew.
This paste, as these hyenas brush up along, you know, pieces of wood or grass or the ground or wherever it is they are, have, of course, the bacteria clings to the paste, and therefore it leaves it behind. And yes, there is a lot of information in that bacteria. Some of the key chemical components mammals use to communicate are their sex, their age, their reproductive status, and other key traits, all part of the fermentation products of symbiotic bacteria, which is living in their scent glands. It identifies different social groups and individuals within a species, and it boils down to the differences in the odor-producing bacterial communities.
Cool.
A smell of their own, as they say. So, good job sniffing that one out, guys.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to number two. Scientists have reportedly succeeded in killing a bacteria using a protein taken from a virus. Everyone thinks this is the fiction except Bob. Bob went with the turnip one. And this one is the fiction.
Crap.
Ah. It is. Sorry, Bob.
GWR, Bob. GWR.
This news came out just hours ago, in fact, and only one place, as far as at least a few hours ago, had picked up on this from Haaretz in Israel, because the researchers are from Israel. So by the time you read about this, there may be other places reporting on it, and there might be actually some new news to report. But for now, this is the only report. So a group of Israeli researchers have succeeded in isolating a protein that kills bacteria. They did not kill the bacteria, but they did isolate the protein that kills the bacteria. So it's E. coli is what they were able to kill. And it's a phage. It's a bacteriophage, which is a virus, right?
I love them.
Yeah, very cool stuff.
And they are so cool looking.
There are more of them than any other organism on the planet.
Yes, that's
isn't that
right.
Amazing. Yeah. And they have a life cycle to them called the lytic cycle. So they infect a bacterial host. They hijack the host's cellular machinery to produce many copies of themselves. And then they go from there to find new hosts. So what this one does, though, is that they've isolated the protein that stops the chromosomes from dividing in the cells, so that the cell gets bigger and bigger, but there's no splitting of the chromosome with that. So effectively what they're saying is that if this holds true, you could actually get these bacteria to burst or kind of destroy themselves in the process. At least that's what they're going to go for when they try to make drugs using these kinds of techniques. And perhaps it will complement, if not someday, hopefully replace antibacterials. I
doubt it's going to replace antibiotics. The problem is that it probably doesn't kill them fast enough in order to overcome the infection.
Right.
See. I mean, this is not going to be, it's not clear whether or not this will pan out as actually clinically useful, but it might.
Not clear, right? And right, you're right, Steve. That's far away. Many, 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 many steps. A lot of research still to do on that. And they don't know that the bacteria doesn't have some sort of mechanism to actually prevent that from happening. But at least the researchers were able to isolate the protein, and that was what made the news. They didn't kill the bacteria, but they isolated the protein that works against the bacteria. So. Good job figuring that one out, guys, which means the last one, a new study suggests that the bacteria found in a turnip might prevent flu, and human clinical trials are happening right now, is science. And we have to go to Japan for this one. Japanese pickled turnips are what they are. And they apparently have protective effects in preventing people from catching the flu. And yes, the human trials have been have begun on this. Let's see. Specifically, researchers said a new study was underway in which they are giving people a probiotic drink. Very good, Steve. Containing the same KB290 strain of the bacterium found in the pickled turnip.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Yep.
So show me the clinical trials.
Well, they did it in the mice studies, and they said it was strong enough to prevent infection of the H1N1 flu strain. So, you know, as usual, you start with the mice, and you you go from there. But certainly sure. not the naked rat mole. They had problems
mole rat.
When they tried yeah. naked mole rat, whatever.
They're bitter enemies of the rat moles, so please yeah. get it right.
Opposite, direct opposite. So, good job, Rebecca, Jay, and Steve. Bob,
thank you.
Bob, I appreciate your bravery, so brownie points for that one.
Thanks for covering. Everyone did a good job.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, well done.
Thanks, Ep.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I have a quote sent in by a listener named John Setterfield. And John sent me a quote from an author named Michael E. Mann. Anybody ever hear of Michael E. Mann?
He was on our show.
We interviewed him not long ago.
Not too long ago.
Michael Mann. Mann.
The hockey stick. That way. The hockey stick.
Exactly. I got a fantastic quote from Michael. Ready? Although scientific revolutions in how we see the world do occur, the bulk of our scientific understanding comes from the cumulative impact of numerous incremental studies that together paint an increasingly coherent picture of how nature works. And I thought that was well suited for some of the topics that we discussed today.
Sure.
Quote by Michael E. Mann.
After we recorded this episode, we learned of the death of Sylvia Brown, who died at age 77 on Wednesday, November 20th. So we will have a more complete discussion of this on next week's show. All right, guys. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.